FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. It's Carrie Lutz. We had Robert Mazur on a while back. We were talking about his book, The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. Well, as you know, the drug trade hasn't stopped, hasn't slowed down. It's probably picked up quite a bit. And all the transactions that take place in the drug industry take place in cash. And the cash has to be moved around. It's got to be invested and it's got to be transferred back. And Robert's an expert. It all requires laundering. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
So obviously what happened with the Escobar cartel there, that was a while ago, but it's still going on and it's become more sophisticated, much more ingrained into society, hasn't it?
Oh, it certainly has. You know, and although we've become, as a nation, become more effective in identifying the financial institutions that are involved in this type of activity, we unfortunately have taken a position with respect to punishment to be punishment by fine rather than punishment by imprisonment or loss of license. There's a body of cases that have been returned in the last 5 or 6 years that have identified many banks, and we can just talk quickly about one of them, which is the HSBC scandal that came out about a year or so ago. But HSBC, if your listeners want to get the real details about the criminality that was occurring in the way of carrying out, of laundering, of moving money all over the world, trying to help their clients to keep it secret from government, read the Senate subcommittee report that was the subcommittee was chaired by Senator Levin. So if you put in Senator Levin HSBC subcommittee report, you'll get it. Don't get lost in the weeds in the 300 and some pages of the report. The first 25 or so are an executive summary, and it really hits to the hard points of what they were doing. And in that instance, what they were doing, and this was mostly being carried out by their branches in Mexico, as well as some of the branches in the United States. Some people don't recognize that there were, at the time, 470 U.S. branches of HSBC and $200 billion in assets. A lot of money, processing $400 trillion in wire transfers. That's a big financial institution. And among the things that they did is that they moved for the Sinaloa cartel, the largest in Mexico, and also the Norte de Valle cartel, the largest in Colombia, nearly $1 billion, at least. It went into the many billions, but certainly $881 million was specifically identified through investigations that were done. This is cash that was going across teller windows in handcrafted wooden boxes made to perfectly fit within the opening at the HSBC branch in Sinaloa, branches in Sinaloa, the state in which and the city in which the heads of the Sinaloa cartel lived and worked. You can't convince me for 1 second that the account managers at HSBC that manage those accounts didn't specifically know who that they were dealing with. They clearly had to have known. And if they didn't know, that would be a tremendous embarrassment with respect to the intelligence of the people that they hire. There's just no way. And as a matter of fact, there were wiretaps that were done in Mexico of a senior cartel leader who was caught on tape saying the best place to take your money to get it laundered is HSBC. HSBC not only moved cash for the cartels, but they created a paper bank in Grand Cayman that moved large amounts of U.S. dollars for account holders, and it was spoken about within the personnel at HSBC as accounts being used for organized crime. They were dealing with a bank in Saudi Arabia, the largest privately held bank, El Raji Bank. That is a bank whose the key founder of that bank was a documented financial supporter of Al Qaeda, and they provided that bank with $1 billion in U.S. currency. Why is that important? Because U.S. currency is a global currency, and it's important for a bank that wants to deal in the international markets to be able to get that type of currency. There are all types of other transactions. They were stripping information off of wire transfers, enabling their account holders to bust the sanctions and deal secretly with Iran, thereby improve their economy despite the sanctions that were imposed by the United States and other nations on Iran in an effort to curtail their development of nuclear weapons. So why is that important? If we look at our Department of Justice's position with respect to the HSBC case, when asked, and I have to say that there is a silver lining in the congressional cloud about this case, and in my view, that's Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, who, if your listeners really want to get to the heart of the HSBC case, just Google Elizabeth Warren, HSBC, YouTube. There's about three or four different clips that are on there where she asks them, for example, and this is the heads of the regulatory and law enforcement agencies that were responsible for fining HSBC $1.92 billion in fines and forfeitures, which sounds like a lot until you look closely. That was about 10% of their 2012 pre-tax profits,
right.
Net profits. That's not much of a penalty, in my opinion. But she asked them, you know, how many billions of dollars do you have to launder for drug lords before somebody says, we're shutting you down, we're going to take your license? Nobody could answer that.
Yeah.
And if you're caught with an ounce of cocaine, chances are you're going to go to jail. And if it happens repeatedly, you may go to jail for the rest of your life. But evidently, if you launder nearly $1 billion for drug cartels and violate our international sanctions, your company pays a fine and you go home and sleep in your own bed at night. When pressed on this, Eric Holder, his position, and he qualified it by saying, I'm not talking about HSBC, I'm talking about any bank that is of that size, is, and this is a quote from him, I'm concerned that the size of some of these institutions becomes so large that it does become difficult for us to prosecute them when we're hit with indications that if you do prosecute, if you do bring a criminal charge, it will have a negative impact on the national economy, perhaps even the world economy. I don't think that's necessarily what we felt we would be getting in the way of thinking by the number one law enforcement officer in our nation. They, I don't think, have a responsibility to be trying to decide whether the economics of prosecuting someone makes any sense. Maybe that's why our prisons are so full of low-level drug traffickers, because there's no economic penalty to the United States for prosecuting them. But when you look closely at Eric Holder and the other person that was the architect of not just the HSBC, but the Wachovia Bank, very similar case, many other banks that were caught handling this hot money, you find a fellow by the name of Lanny Brewer, who's the chief of the criminal division. Lanny Brewer and Eric Holder together are the architects of this. Lanny Brewer and Eric Holder, before they came to the Department of Justice, worked for the law firm of Covington & Burling. Covington & Burling in Washington represents the who's who of banks around the world. And after PBS did a special called The Untouchables, another thing well worth your listeners Googling and looking at, it's about a 20-minute piece. Basically, it was confronting Lanny Brewer about the Untouchables being the Wall Street banks. They were untouchable with prosecution despite their criminal conduct. He resigned shortly after that, and according to the New York Times, went back to Covington & Burling, where he enjoys a $4 million a year salary. I'm just suggesting that an apparent appearance of a conflict of interest is something that we need to avoid, because it can corrode some of the confidence that we might otherwise have in the basis of decisions that are being made by prosecutors when it comes to dealing with these international banks. It would have been better, in my view, for those types of decisions to have been made by career prosecutors who are not worried about rushing back to the law firm that represents the banks as soon as they leave the Department of Justice.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, they basically got a free pass and they get to do it again. Hey, you know, Eric Holder, he's also had some dealings with the cartel in a scandal known as Fast and Furious, where they were giving that same cartel weapons, right? You think there's any connection?
Well, Fast and Furious is a total embarrassment for law enforcement, in my view. Anytime you're going to do an undercover operation and you are going to provide resources to bad guys, it needs to be done in a very, very heavily supervised manner where you know that the evidence that you're going to get is worth giving the bad guys something that they can't get anywhere else. That's the theory behind the money laundering operations. When I worked undercover as a money launderer within the cartel, I could have laundered hundreds of millions of dollars. And our attack, our approach on that was to find reasons not to launder money for the same people over and over and over again. You're not getting new information. You're not identifying new targets. It may sound like a lot of money. I laundered in the operation that's the subject of my book, The Infiltrator, a little bit more than $34 million. But, you know, $34 million, when you compare it to the $65 billion a year generated in the United States from the sale of illegal drugs and the amount of money that's under the control of the cartel, $34 million. But what did we get for it? We took down the seventh largest privately held bank in the world. We imprisoned many of the members, senior members of the bank, including people on the board. We arrested nearly 100 drug traffickers. We were able to dismantle a pipeline that was bringing in tons of cocaine at a time. But in Fast and Furious, here's the system. I mean, what they did is they gave guns to bad guys that they knew were going to take these guns down to Mexico and use them for criminal activity. But they had no way to track the guns. They barely did any surveillance at times when the guns were being sold. There were actually complaints by the gun dealers who were working with the government to make these illegal sales, complaining that they recognized that these bad guys were walking out the door. And there wasn't any way to track them. There wasn't any chip in them and satellite tracking. There wasn't anything that was able to be done. And anybody who's ever done surveillance or even family members who've tried to follow somebody from point A to point B to go to a party knows that even when you're following somebody who knows you're following him, it's not easy to stay together when you get a bad timing on a red light or something along those lines. So tracking those with surveillance is not likely to result in your being able to figure out where they ultimately go. And we put guns in the hands of a lot of criminals, some guns that were actually used to kill our own law enforcement officers in the United States.
Yeah, and to this day, the Department of Justice still hasn't come clean on exactly what the whole operation was about. So getting back to this, want to talk about where it's all heading, how it undermines the country, and how it's a danger to the United States, both our interests and our safety here at home on the Financial Survival Network.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
People have been using gold and silver to protect their wealth for thousands of years. Shouldn't you? That's why I go to Cloud Hard Assets. Tom Cloud has been in the business for 38 years. Call him now at 800-247-2812. Tom's service is outstanding and you can buy with complete confidence. Order today and you'll have your metal in your hands in 10 days or less. Tom takes the guesswork out of what to buy and you'll buy at the lowest possible prices. And as a special to FSN listeners, you'll get free shipping and insurance. So call Tom today at 800-247-2812. That's 800-247-2812 or find him on the web at cloudhardassets.com and tell him Kerry sent you.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
And if you just tuned in, we've got Robert Major on with us now. He was an undercover agent and went under deep cover, infiltrated the Escobar cartel, and basically showed just whose interest the banksters really have at heart. And I'd love to think that, Robert, something really changed in the interim, but just looking at the HSBC case and so many other cases that have happened since since your experience, you know, what is it going to take to get the banks to really act in not just the U.S.'s interest, but in the interest of law-abiding citizens all over?
Well, in my view, what it's going to take is going to be the vigorous prosecution of the individuals within the bank responsible for the bank's criminal conduct. You know, banks don't launder money. People do. Individuals make these alliances with people within the criminal underworld. When we prosecuted the senior management of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, I also got the opportunity after their prosecution to be on a debriefing team. That, to me, was the biggest eye-opener that I ever had in my life about the financial markets and just how deep the talons of the underworld are in the financial markets. First, the theme from the BCCI officers was, why are you picking on us? We're not doing anything different than the rest of the international banking community. Now, I never really wanted to embrace that. I found that so unimaginable. But then as I began in recent years to look at the prosecutions of banks or the banks that have been involved in criminal activity, and I see what is being done, I've read the indictments, I've read the deferred prosecutions, and the techniques that were being used at the Bank of Credit and Commerce, which is a very, very sophisticated technique that are used to help people to hide money from governments, are the exact same techniques that are being used today. If we look at the banks that were prosecuted, one of the techniques is stripping wire transfers. That means stripping off the information, the real information, about who's sending it and who's receiving this information, and diverting the attention from the illegal purpose or the illegal location in which the money is going to go. Well, you know, if we just look at the banks that have admitted criminal conduct in connection with stripping wire transfers, and I'll read them off to you quickly. August of 2010, Barclays Bank entered into a deferred prosecution. That's a contract that says, yeah, we did it. We'll pay a fine. We won't do it again. And as long as we don't do it again, then the indictment gets dismissed. Well, they get that in August of 2010. They paid a $298 million fine. ABN AMRO, the largest bank at the time in Belgium, May of 2010, forfeited $500 million for stripping wire transfers. Credit Suisse in 2009, $536 million for stripping wire transfers. Lloyds Bank in January 2009, deferred prosecution, $350 million for stripping wire transfers. Ing, in June of 2012, paid a $619 million fine for stripping wire transfers. Yeah. Standard Charter Bank agreed to a fine of $340 million and then paid an additional $327 million. BNP Paribas, this year, June of 2014, pled guilty to conspiring to violate the Trading with the Enemy Act. Again, stripping wire transfers. Moving nearly $9 billion for sanctioned entities. Now, those are just the banks involved in wire stripping.
That were caught. Right? How many haven't been caught?
You know, now if we go through the list of shame for those found to be involved in moving drug money, Bank Atlantic, deferred prosecution, $10 million. Ocean Bank, deferred prosecution, $11 million. American Express International, forfeited $55 million. Union Bank of California, $21.6 million. Wachovia, $160 million. HSBC, $1.92 billion. And a Lebanese Canadian bank, blacklisted by the Treasury Department, it got sold off to a French bank. But they were involved very, very heavily in a major drug case called the Juma case. But and then we look at the banks that admit to criminal conduct in connection with their assisting U.S. citizens to evade income taxes. These are not the top 2% that pay taxes, because the top 2% in the United States don't pay taxes because right. They have the help of these types of banks. Union Bank of Switzerland, they entered into a deferred prosecution in 2009 and paid a $780 million fine. Deutsche Bank, 2010, deferred prosecution, $553 million fine. Credit Suisse wound up in May of 2014, pleading guilty to conspiracy to evade U.S. income taxes and paid a $2.5 billion fine. They created, for 22,000 Americans, they hid roughly $12 billion. And going back to the Union Bank of Switzerland created 50,000 secret accounts for U.S. citizens. That's why we all, you, I, your listeners, pay the heavy taxes that we do. And that's because the people that should really be paying a much heavier load get the help of highly sophisticated international banks that help them to be able to hide their money from the U.S. government.
It's really, well, I can't say it's shocking because, you know, look, I knew this is going on. So shocking is not the right term, but the breadth of it, the number of entities involved. And these are just the ones that have recently been caught. And look, which ones aren't doing it? I think that's more shocking to find out the ones that are really honest, that aren't, that are refraining from making profits doing this. Because when you say they strip the real data off the wire transfers to conceal the real parties involved, and you know that will throw the authorities off the trail. So obviously there's a drug cartel involved or persons that will trigger, right, set off a red flag.
Yeah, this is the authorities get around the filters.
Right.
The filters that are set up at the Fed and SWIFT in order to prevent people from dealing with certain individuals or dealing with certain nations. But, you know, I really do think that there's two things that can be done that could make a difference here. One of the things is internally within the financial institution. There needs to be no longer two brains. There's two brains in a bank. There's a sales brain and there's a compliance brain.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, they're not all part of the same brain. And, you know, the compliance people get their rewards based upon efficiently working their compliance programs and reducing the risk that the bank otherwise faces by reporting properly and by not dealing with individuals that they shouldn't be dealing with. Unfortunately, the sales side doesn't have any incentives that are tied to compliance. Guys and gals who go out and bring in accounts with big deposits are paid on commissions. They get, you know, they've got a base salary, but their salaries are going to be supplemented by the amount of deposits that they can bring in.
Right.
So when compliance is saying, you know, this is a high-risk account, we shouldn't be doing it, they're coming up with every excuse they can possibly come up with for why this is just normal and we just need to be dealing with this. And this is an age-old problem that's been going on for decades in banks. One bank, and I found out about this by accident, I went to an anti-money laundering compliance seminar in the Caribbean. I was one of the speakers there, and we were staying at a resort. And there just happened to be a family there. The husband was a senior executive with a major bank in the New York metropolitan area. And he wasn't at the conference. He was just there vacationing with his family. And I told him what I did, what I was doing there. And he said to me, you know, we don't have that problem anymore. Our senior management came up with a plan, and I had to sign a contract. And my contract says this, that if compliance says that an account should be closed, and I have reasons for why I think compliance is finding are ill-advised and that we should continue to work with that account, if senior management accepts my position and overrides compliance, I am now responsible for fivefold of any loss that the bank incurs as a result of that account being kept open.
Skin in the game.
Got skin in the game now. He can't possibly just turn a blind eye because he's otherwise going to financially destroy himself from being involved in that. And that really is I think the key to getting banks internally to try to do the right thing by creating on the sales side a need for adhering to compliance good practices. The other thing is that the federal government does not track the main pieces of evidence that can take them to the biggest money launderers in the world every single year. And what they need to be doing, they need to be tracking the bulk cash movements around the world in U.S. dollars. Now, I talked before about HSBC moving $106 billion in U.S. currency repatriated back into the United States in just under 3 years. And of that $106 billion, they reported only 19 suspicious transactions.
Yeah.
This is when they buy cash principally from financial institutions around the world.
Right.
Now, this cash, in many instances, was being bought from houses of exchange, houses de cambio, in different parts of the world, many of them in Mexico. You know, for decades now, the federal government has been telling financial institutions the most high-risk account you can possibly have is one that is involved in exchanging currency in areas known to be collection points for drugs, for large shipments.
That's common sense.
Well, unfortunately, other than apparently HSBC, Wachovia, Union Bank of California, and many others didn't read those alerts because that's where they were getting a lot of their cash from. But the point being that if you track the currency, and this was a watershed moment for me working undercover. I was meeting with a BCCI officer, and I learned about the importance of the cash from him. What he said to me was, you know who the biggest money launderer in the United States is? And I is undercover and 2 or 3 in the morning in a club. I'm thinking I'm going to get the greatest lead in the world. Yeah. And he says, well, it's the Federal Reserve, of course.
Yeah,
and
the Federal Reserve. Yeah.
I said, what? You got to be kidding me, the Federal Reserve. He goes, no, listen, here's the logic of this. The Bank of the Republic, which is their central bank in Colombia, the Bank of the Republic, the United, and they refused. It was illegal for anyone in Colombia to have a U.S. dollar account. Couldn't have it. So what did they have? And you could find this going on the internet and Googling it. They had at the central bank, at the Bank of the Republic, a window that was called the sinister window or the anonymous window. And they allowed people to come with as much U.S. currency as they had, exchange it for pesos at a favorable rate, and they would take the cash in. Now, what does the Bank of the Republic do with the currency? Well, they are, just like any other central bank that deals dollars,
they ship it to the U.S.
They're members. They are members of the Federal Reserve, or indirectly through someone else, they will be able to dispose of their U.S. currency back to the Federal Reserve. So they were sending pallet loads of cash on planes, container loads of cash back to the United States, billions and billions of dollars. And as this banker said to me, don't you think there's someone with enough sense at the Federal Reserve that they know if Colombians cannot have dollar accounts, what the heck is their central bank doing bringing billions of dollars back to the United States? That's totally ignored by the Federal Reserve. And you can't tell me that there aren't people intelligent enough to recognize that. So what do we need? We need records from the Federal Reserve to be monitored very, very closely. We cannot allow them to take the position that this is proprietary information that they can't provide unless it's subpoenaed. If they need a subpoena, we'll give them a subpoena.
Exactly.
We need to know who is sending back the bulk cash, and we need to follow the bulk cash.
Follow the money.
And that's going to help you tremendously.
Exactly.
That's just one thing. There are many other things.
And on that note, Robert, just tell us your website and how we get your book.
Sure. The website is the-infiltrator.com. That's the-infiltrator.com. If you go on that website, among other things, you'll see a tab that says where to buy. Click on that, and it'll give you the links to Amazon and the other major book distributors that you can buy the book online. You can get it either in hard copy, or you can get it for your Kindle, and it's also being sold in other languages.
Excellent. And, of course, you'll find the link to Robert's site on the financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Also, sign up for our newsletter, and don't forget, sign up for the free webinar that's taking place on September 24th at 9 p.m. We'll talk about what the future of the world economy is and how you get prepared for it. Thanks so much for being on again, Robert. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.